Hello, hello everybody, and welcome to Causes or Cures. I'm Dr. Eakes, your host. Thank you so much for joining in for this episode. Hope you guys are doing well. As always, it is great to have you here. So as some of you know, I have been focusing on a few topics for 2022. Mind you, we talk about everything, but there are some focus points, so to speak. One of them is obesity, the other, the opioid epidemic, and third, industry's influence on health and healthcare and health policy. And this episode hits two of those. Today, I will be chatting with Dr. Janet Curry about her recent research that was published in the Annals of the American Academy of Political and Social Science. The title of her paper was, "The Opioid Epidemic Was Not Caused by Economic Distress, but by factors that could be more rapidly addressed." She is going to talk us through the history of the opioid epidemic, how it started, explain why prescriptions for opioids and health policy is what really fueled the epidemic. She will also discuss how economic factors impacted opioid use and overdose, and ways we can address the epidemic. You guys might have noticed, you'll read articles about states getting money from lawsuits related to the opioid epidemics, and that money is meant for them to address the epidemic. But, you know, in order to do that, we need to know what caused it, right? To get the solutions right, we have to know what caused it. Who is Dr. Curry? I of course will link to her bio in the podcast description, but she is an economist and a professor of economics and public affairs at Princeton University. And she is the co-director of Princeton Center for Health and Well-Being. She is also co-director of the Program on Families and Children at the National Bureau of Economic Research. She was named a NAMIS Distinguished Scientist in 2019 and was named one of the top 10 women in economics in 2015 by the World Economics Forum. She has served as the president of the American Society of Health Economics, the Society of Labor Economics, and vice president of the American Economic Association. She is considered a pioneer in the economic analysis of child development, and her current research focuses on socioeconomic differences in health, access to health care, and environmental threats on health, to name a few. So that said, let's connect to Dr. Curry and see what she has to say about the opioid epidemic. 1 second while I connect. All right, so on the line, we have Dr. Janet Curry. Thank you so much for joining us on Causes or Cures. I read your research paper. There's obviously a lot of interest in the opioid epidemic, but I was curious, how did you become interested in what causes the opioid epidemic? And maybe you can provide a little bit about the work you do.
Okay, sure. Well, thanks for asking me to be here. I guess one reason why I became interested in the topic was, well, obviously it's really important. It's a major cause of death in the U.S. now, and that's not happening in other countries. So clearly there's something that's different about the U.S. than in other places. And the narrative that you hear all the time is that it has something to do with economic decline in the U.S. But when I started looking into that, I thought, well, that doesn't make any sense. It's not like the U.S. is way more depressed than any other place. Mm-hmm. And in fact, the period of time when the epidemic really took off was a period of great prosperity. It really took off before the Great Recession in 2008, when we had really low unemployment. And then once the economy recovered after 2008, we saw the peak of the epidemic, you know, prior to what's been going on during the pandemic. The peak was in 2017 when we had 3-4% unemployment. So the story that people were telling just didn't make any sense. And I wanted to look into it further.
And do you teach at Princeton? You or and that's where you do your research?
Yes, I'm a professor of economics and public affairs at Princeton University.
Very nice. All right, so let's talk about your research. What is the real cause, in your opinion, of the opioid epidemic? And it looked like it went back to the 1970s when people redefined pain, and pain was called the fifth vital sign. I was wondering if you could walk us through that and how that led to, you know, I guess a new approach to pain, new drugs, and then this marketing campaign.
Yes. So I think the change in attitudes about pain kind of set the stage for what happened later. And so some of that was the realization that there were a lot of patients who were suffering a lot and maybe they didn't need to suffer. And so the idea became popular among doctors that they had a duty to treat pain and to ask about pain and as you say, to treat it sort of like the fifth vital sign, something that they should always be checking. Around this time also, pain medicine became a specialty, so that's a recognition that it was important. As I say, that started happening in the late 70s, during the 80s, but the opioid epidemic didn't start until companies like Purdue Pharma and some other companies later introduced what they marketed as a new generation of opioids, which they said were not addictive. Okay, so OxyContin was marketed as a safe and non-addictive way to treat pain. And Purdue spent millions of dollars aggressively marketing these drugs. These opioids were promoted for things like back pain, which is now thought to be very inappropriate, even though there's still a lot of it going on. Because the thing about opioids is that you build up a tolerance for them. So to get the same amount of pain relief, you have to take more over time.
Right, right, right.
So eventually, if you have something like lower back pain, what you're going to end up with is you're still going to have lower back pain and you're going to have opioid addiction on top of that.
Right.
So it was promoted for things like that, for wisdom teeth removal. We still see a lot of opioid prescriptions are from dentists.
Yep.
You know, and this marketing was very pervasive. So it's targeting doctors, hospitals, medical schools, and even there was a group established called the American Pain Society, which was largely funded by drug manufacturers. It had an academic journal called the Journal of Pain. You know, so there's a lot of promotion of this idea that you should be prescribing opioids to people and that it was safe to do that. But, you know, that's turned out to be a lie. And, you know, we see all the lawsuits going on.
Against I know, every day. Purdue,
right. Yeah. So, and there's so much evidence has accumulated about how dangerous these drugs are. So one famous study looked at people who go to the emergency room, and if they happen to get treated by a doctor who prescribes a lot of opioids, then they're more likely to get an opioid, and then they're more likely to still be taking opioids 6 months later.
Wow.
So what that shows you is like a one-time random encounter can lead to people becoming addicted.
Right, right. And they knew they knew that these, you know, that's why all the lawsuits, I suppose, are happening right from the get-go. In your opinion, based on your research, they knew that these drugs were more addicting than they were letting on.
Well, a lot of evidence has come out as a result of the lawsuits that yes, they knew all along and that they tried to suppress that information.
I wanted to specifically ask you, you talked a little bit about the ER doctor and the, or the ER study. But what this aggressive marketing campaign, what did it do to prescriptions? Did they did, how like by how much did they increase?
So they quadrupled between 1999 and 2013. And something I think Americans don't really understand is how different things are in the US than other countries. So the US now consumes about 70% of the world's opioids.
Wow, 70%.
Yeah, it's a really big number.
My
So,
gosh.
we have this huge problem, and there's a lot of factors that led up to that. We allow this kind of marketing campaign to go on where it wouldn't be allowed in other countries, just as one example.
The direct to we can do direct to consumer marketing here, and that was part of the opioid marketing campaign, I assume. And there's two other countries that allow that. A lot of other countries don't, right?
A lot of other countries don't. A lot of other countries essentially don't allow doctors to prescribe opioids except in certain circumstances, right? So here, doctors can essentially prescribe anything to anybody. The CDC has put out guidelines saying that opioids shouldn't be used for things like chronic pain,
Right.
that they shouldn't be prescribed in like 30-day prescriptions. You should give people 7 days or 10 days. But those are just guidelines. They're not binding on anybody. Whereas in most other countries, they have pretty strict rules about prescribing them.
I just read recently their new guidelines that they were thinking about putting out for 2022, and it looked like they were getting some pushback from pain doctors and maybe pain patients.
Yeah, so one thing I should state, people often talk about cancer patients, and I don't think there's any guideline that would prevent cancer patients from getting access to these drugs. Just before all this marketing took place, most doctors thought that opioids were so dangerous that you should only prescribe them for people who were terminally ill. And it seems like, if they had stuck to that belief, that we would have been better off.
One thing I wanted to ask, so there's obviously an overprescription problem, obviously in here in the States. What has been done to curb the overprescribing of opioids?
So there's a number of things that have been done. Some of them are the establishment of prescription drug monitoring programs in each state, the passage of naloxone access laws, guidelines about opioid prescribing, as we were just discussing, and also the expansion of health insurance under the Affordable Care Act. So just to talk about those things in turn, prescription drug monitoring program is a state requirement that pharmacies register every prescription of opioids in a database. And then doctors can check that database to make sure that patients aren't getting multiple opioid prescriptions. And there's been a lot of studies of these which have shown that they do reduce prescribing in states where doctors are required to use them. So that's one thing. The naloxone access laws allow naloxone, which is an overdose reversing drug, to be prescribed to third parties like parents or friends, or in some cases, they require that naloxone be prescribed at the same time as an opioid so that somebody
Interesting.
has it. And those laws have also been effective at reducing opioid overdoses, compared to what we would have had without them. The Affordable Care Act has also been important, because we know, 10 million people got access to health insurance as a result of the Affordable Care Act. So part of that is that it increased access to drug treatment, which is a really good thing in principle, although in practice, drug treatment programs are kind of lightly regulated, and a lot of them don't offer the most effective treatment, which is medication-assisted treatment.
And I feel like the situation has changed a little bit recently with, you hear about fentanyl now. I know it's always been around, but I feel like I hear about it in the news all the time.
Yes, it is true. Most of the overdoses now are coming from fentanyl. I guess an important thing to keep in mind is that most people who are using fentanyl started off using prescription opioids. So it's
interesting. I guess that takes us back to the things that are in place. I always tell people, I think they should get the fentanyl testing strips, hand those out too. Kind of like a harm reduction policy, but.
Oh yeah, that I'm sure that would save some lives. But given that you have a bunch of people who are addicted to opioids, and it's a very powerful addiction, it's very, very hard to get off of it, which is why medication-assisted treatment is so important, because it reduces the cravings and helps people to stay off of them. So what we need, I think, to deal with fentanyl is much wider access to treatment programs. Right now, only about 30% of people who want to get treatment are able to find it. That's just not acceptable.
Right. It won't help solve the problem. I wanted to shift gears a little bit and talk about this narrative, this popular narrative that the opioid overdose are linked to economic factors. And I just wanted to tell you the reason I was so interested in this topic. Yes, I work in public health, but I came from like a really small, I grew up in a really small rural town, went to Catholic school. And you can see the effects of the opioid epidemic at every generation. And so I was just so interested in, was this economic factors, the loss of jobs, the increase in automation, or was it, the prescription factors? It's just to see it at every level, even from my high school. My sister and I were talking last night how many people we knew that died of an overdose, or even parents, a kid and a parent both died of an overdose after they became addicted. It was just grandparents going back to work to raise kids because their kids died. So it was just one of those things where you didn't know. But that being said, what is the link based on your research between, socioeconomic status and opioid use, opioid deaths?
So it's actually really interesting the way that you were talking about it, like it's either this or it's that, because it isn't either or. There is a relationship between the sort of long-term economic factors that you were talking about and opioid abuse. It's just that it's not the whole story. It's not even most of the story. And without the other parts, the widespread prescribing, the lack of access to treatment and so on, we wouldn't have the public health crisis that we have. But that said, there is some support for the idea that long-term unemployment affects opioid use. So, for example, there was a 2020 study that found that in areas where car plants had shut down, that there was an increase in opioid overdoses sort of 5 years later, right? So that's suggesting that it's a long-term unemployment problem that is linked. There's also a lot of work looking at trade shocks. So places that were strongly impacted, say, by imports from China and experienced loss of manufacturing jobs. And again, there's a link there, but it's relatively small. So one study found that if you moved from the bottom quarter to the top quarter of exposure to trade shocks, that that would explain about 10 to 15% of the increases in overdoses. So yes, there's something there, but it's not the main story. If you think about it from a public policy point of view, that's actually a good thing, because it's very hard to reverse long-term economic decline in an area, and it would take a really long time.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas some of these other things, like reducing prescribing and increasing access to treatment, you could do on a much shorter time horizon and really move the needle in terms of improving things.
And I thought it was interesting in your research, you looked at employment on both a state level and a county level. Can you explain why you did that and if you saw any differences?
Sure. So, if you think about a state, like California, there's both really wealthy areas and really poor areas. And when we're talking about things like long-term lack of employment, that is going to affect some areas within a state then and not others, right? So the state is really a very big level to be looking at if you're trying to look at the relationship between employment and opioids. So we looked in our work at the county level, and we could look at counties over a long period of time. So look at changes in employment in the counties and see how are those related to changes in opioid prescribing. And basically, we didn't see any relationship. And again, if you think about it, it's not so surprising. Most of the opioid prescriptions were going to people who are employed, and most of them are actually being paid for by private health insurance. So it's not the case that it's like only unemployed people who are turning to opioids.
Right. No, that's a great point. So if we address these economic problems, what you're saying is that they will help, but they're not going to solve the problem.
No, I don't think they, well, first of all, we don't really know how to address the problems in a very
okay.
constructive way. So people, they have economic empowerment zones and all kinds of policies have been tried, but we still have areas of the country that are poor and they stay poor like over decades, right? So if we knew how to fix that problem, hopefully we would have done something about it.
We'd figure it out by now. Yeah.
Yeah. So I feel like that narrative is a very hopeless narrative. It's just saying, well, there's some places that are poor and this is what happens when you have people who are poor. And again, it is true that poor people are more at risk of overdoses, but the difference is not as great as you might think. So people in poor households are 1.4 times as likely to overdose as people in non-poor households, right? So it's not like it's 10 times or 5 times.
Right, I was just going to say it's not like huge, right?
Yeah, that's right. There is a bigger difference by education. So people who have less than a bachelor's degree, whether it's a community college degree or high school or less than high school, have a risk that's about 2.5 times higher than someone with a bachelor's degree. So that is a significant difference. But again, it's maybe not as big as people think. So in other words, there's a lot of people who are, educated, working, presumably have no reason particularly to be in economic despair and yet still have an opioid problem.
I think that's really important for people to understand, just because of sometimes when people, they get an image of someone who has an addiction And it's a very like stereotypical image that's not correct.
That's right. And in fact, along that line, the first group of people to really be affected by the opioid epidemic were actually middle-aged white ladies.
Oh, interesting.
And the reason for that is because middle-aged white ladies go to the doctor more than a lot of other people, and so that put them at risk of getting prescribed to. They go with aches and pains, and then they would get these opioid prescriptions.
That's interesting. That was the first group to,
Yeah.
wow, I didn't know that. Interesting. So based on your research and the current state of things right now, I know we just obviously we're still in this pandemic, but we've always had the opioid epidemic. What more can be done to address the epidemic? Like you said, we see all these lawsuits, and I know some states are saying, oh, we're going to use the money for various opioid prevention programs, this and that. But in your opinion, what more needs to be done?
So I do think we need to do more on the supply side. So we shouldn't have doctors giving people, especially new patients, like people who haven't taken opioids before, they shouldn't be going to the doctor with aches and pains and getting a 30-day supply of opioids. That's just a recipe for creating addicts. So, we could do things like we could use these prescription drug monitoring program registries to investigate doctors who are prescribing a lot of opioids. We could also adopt some of the measures in other countries, like putting restrictions on who can prescribe opioids or requiring more training for doctors to be able to prescribe opioids. It's kind of crazy that right now we have any doctor, any dentist, or any veterinarian for that matter can prescribe any opioids they like, but we have restrictions on who can prescribe medication-assisted treatment. So, in order to treat opioid addiction, a doctor has to have a special license, and there's restrictions on how many people they're allowed to be treating. Right,
So that
so
seems
no,
backwards, yeah.
it's crazy, right? So that's definitely something that we should be doing, is making it harder to prescribe opioids and easier to prescribe treatment.
Why we do things backwards, I will never understand, but I guess we're not very good at prevention overall, in general.
No, it's very surprising actually that there's so much resistance to medication-assisted treatment. There are lots of chronic conditions where we prescribe medications for people, like diabetics or people with high blood pressure. And, yes, they're going to have to take medication for the rest of their life, and we're okay with that. But then here we have opioid addiction, which is a life-threatening illness. It's a chronic condition. It's not something people just, get over with willpower. And yet, people have all sorts of objections to prescribing them medication that, has been shown can save their life.
Is that resistance like a philosophical one, or is it for some sort of economic reason, or we just don't know?
It seems to be a sort of philosophical reason, and so part of it, I think, is philosophical that, it's wrong to treat drug addiction with other drugs. And part of it, I think, comes from sort of demonizing people who have drug addiction. So not thinking about them as people that have an illness. And I think that's why it's so important to understand how pervasive it is, and that it's not just, people of lower socioeconomic status or, stereotypical drug users. It's sort of people in all walks of life. And a lot of them did nothing to seek this out. It's not like they had drug-seeking behavior. They went to a doctor with a problem, and then they were given opioids, and they became addicted. It really wasn't their fault.
Right. And I think that, you know, just the image people have in their heads, even if we can just change that, maybe it'll help the situation, because it can happen to anybody. Absolutely. And in addition to those things, do you think are you optimistic about these lawsuits and what the states might do with this money? And are you optimistic that maybe drug companies will never market stuff like this again, or that this will result in a changed marketing strategies?
Well, I guess I'm sort of more optimistic in the short term than the long term. We have the example of the tobacco settlement, where states got a lot of money for tobacco remediation. And in the short run, they did do a lot of tobacco remediation with that money. Over the longer term, the money sort of got shifted to other purposes. So we don't see right now very much of that money being spent on tobacco remediation. I fear it may be somewhat similar for opioid mitigation. And the other thing is that I'm not sure that states have a very clear idea about what it is that they should be doing to address the problem. You know, for example, in New Jersey, where I am, there was a lot of discussion under Governor Chris Christie that, well, what we need is residential treatment beds. And that's really not at all clear that that's what we need to combat this epidemic. It's kind of one of the more expensive things that you could do. But there are a lot of cases of people being in residential treatment for, say, 30 days, and then they leave residential treatment. There's no outpatient support, and they go out and immediately overdose and die. Right? So in those cases, the treatment that they got may have actually made them more vulnerable to an overdose instead of less.
That's interesting. So states are getting a bunch of money, but I guess they just don't know what to do with it.
Yeah, I think that's right. They think they should be doing something, and they don't have a very clear idea about what they should be doing. And the sort of this pervasive narrative about how it's all due to unemployment is just not helpful, right, in directing states to what might be effective. As I say, they could use the prescription drug monitoring registries to identify pill mills. They could put money into medication-assisted treatment to make it more available. They could expand outpatient support programs so that people had someplace to go and were able to maintain their jobs and so on while they were getting treatment. So I think there's a lot that states could do. Whether they will do that, that's another matter.
Right, right. Well, maybe I'll send them this podcast after I put it up. I mean, this would be an evidence-informed, at least, you know, research-informed, evidence-based. That's the word I was looking for. I say that word all day long. Evidence-based policies.
Yes.
That could work. Are you doing any more research in this area?
I'm actually not right at the moment working on this. I'm doing a little bit of work on prescription drug monitoring registries, just trying to look. Most of the work that's been done is looking at sort of state level data, as we were discussing. But it is possible to look at individual level data and see whether there's evidence of patients doctor shopping, for instance, or whether there's evidence of doctors doing questionable prescribing. And so just sort of trying to quantify what's going on with the prescribing, I think could be helpful
Oh,
to
yeah,
the debate.
definitely. And you can get it down to an individual level. That's interesting.
You can get data about retail prescriptions at the individual level, which doesn't have people's names on it or anything like that, but allows you to track a patient over time. So you can see a patient who wasn't taking opioids, you can see their first prescription, and then you can see what happens to them after that.
Wow. That's interesting. Well, maybe when you get that research done, if you want to come back on Causes or Cures, I really wanted to try to focus this year on opioids. Also, I'm focusing on obesity and the influence of industry in healthcare policy and that kind of thing. Those were my three topics for 2022. So I really appreciate you coming on and sharing your expertise with us and your research. I think it's really interesting and I think it's really helpful and timely.
Oh, well, thank you very much. I guess we hit two out of three of your priorities, thinking
yes.
about how industry affects things and opioids.
Yes. Well, I tell a lot of people, you know, I always say this when they talk about, you know, misinformation, and we've seen a lot of people just don't seem to trust as much. And then I said, well, you know, I think too, we have to look at the influence of industry, and maybe I just have all different, you know, a theory that if we have to start talking about that and how to make the system better for people to rebuild that trust. And I think the whole opioid epidemic ties into that. You know, what happened and what's being done to rebuild trust and to hold people accountable, you know?
Yeah. Well, I mean, the other thing is that it is sort of frustrating because we have the highest level of opioid prescribing in the world. It's kind of leveled off since people noticed that it was so high, but it hasn't gone down. And so we're still prescribing at very high levels. And now, you know, as I say, there's this sort of narrative about how it's all due to unemployment. We really have to attack unemployment before we can do anything else, you know, leaving aside the fact that we have a 4% unemployment rate now. But then, you know, then people will say, oh, it's not the prescribing anymore, it's fentanyl, right? So
yes.
anything about prescribing is irrelevant. But it's not, right? It's still, opioids are still being prescribed at a very high level. A lot of the people who die with fentanyl in their blood also have prescription opioids in their blood. And so, you know, there's still this on-ramp into addiction, which we haven't really done very much to curb. And that is something that is certainly under control of public policy. And in other countries, they do a much better job, and they haven't had this horrible death from opioids that we have.
Right. No, and that's a great point, because now when you talk about the opioid epidemic, the next word is often fentanyl, and you lose sight of that, the whole prescription side of things. So I think that's a great point to make.
Well, that's right. And there's a reason for that, which is because nobody likes to say that doctors got people addicted to opioids, right? The doctors don't like it.
Yeah.
The companies don't like it. You know, so nobody likes it. And so they just ignore it and focus on other things.
Yeah, no, it's, I agree. It's one of those statements you just don't want to make. You'll get criticized for it, I suppose.
I have been criticized for it.
Yeah. Oh, really? Have you received quite a bit of criticism? Like,
I would say, you know, doctors are not thrilled with this general line of research.
I mean, but it's not blaming doctors. It's just saying what happened, right? There's a difference.
Yeah, but you know, doctors like to perceive themselves as being benevolent and helping people. And so,
yeah.
you know, in many cases, they cause people to die. And, you know, that's very upsetting.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I mean, and I think that's a lot of getting back to the industry influence, a lot of some of the other researchers that I've been bringing on are really focused on, how industry influences, prescribing patterns in general or what drugs people use. And I think just being aware of that influence can be helpful. I just feel like a lot of people just, they're too busy doing their day job. They don't think about what's driving the system. Do you know what I mean? So that's kind of what I would hoped. I don't like, I hope, I certainly don't want to use this podcast to like play the blame game or anything like that. I just like to understand things and how to make things better. Obviously, there's an opioid epidemic, so I mean, we have to try to see what the root causes are. But that's a shame that you get that kind of pushback. I don't know. Well, but it's good that you're still continuing to research the topic and letting your voice be heard. I'm sure there's some people who are receptive, some doctors who are receptive to it.
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, that's a big group, right? Doctors. So some of them are kind of leading the charge in terms of, trying to push for more medication-assisted treatment, trying to come up with more rational guidelines for prescribing. Many hospitals have actually changed the default in their system so that the default is that you get a 7 or a 10 day prescription of opioids, say after surgery, instead of 30 days. So that kind of thing can make a big difference, because now if the doctor in the hospital wants to order opioids, it comes up and says 10 days, they have to actually override it if they want to give 30 days, and they don't do that. So just these things like defaults can make a difference.
Yeah, little things. Absolutely. I mean, I was prescribed opioids after a dental surgery. And I mean, I didn't get addicted, but I was like, man, these feel pretty good. So I totally get it's sort of like this, it starts out very benign, and then, it whether you want to or not, it can lead to a problem for sure.
That's right. And actually, there's research now suggesting that combinations of other types of painkillers can do just as good a job. So it's not even true that opioids are the only game in town.
I just think, I think they're so addicting. Like I remember I have when I post a lot about, the lawsuits because I'm just interested in that kind of thing. And they're all coming in now and large amounts. And I have talked to people who have pain issues and they'll be like, hey, opioids are the only thing that controls my pain, and all these laws, the opioid epidemic are ma ma is making it harder for me to get my medication. So I'm aware of that too. And I don't know what their exact health issues are, but I guess that's part of this issue too. How do you make sure that, those people are able to access their medication? I recently had a conversation with a veteran who runs Weed for Warriors, and he's trying to make weed more accessible to veterans. And he was talking about how a lot of veterans are, turned to that and stopped using opioids, and they wanted to stop using opioids because there was a problem with addiction. But I guess it's like little aspects like that, that can be very sensitive.
Yeah, well, it is very hard once people are addicted to get them off. How do you know when somebody says, "Oh, opioids are the only thing that control my pain?" How do you know that that's true, right? It is true that if they stopped taking opioids, they would have withdrawal and they would feel terrible.
Right. I mean, but how do you argue with them too? Like that's such a sensitive
Sure.
topic. But I agree with you. I guess you don't really know, but and they're powerful, so they do work. And they probably do work, well, but and yeah, and then trying to switch to another thing and going through that withdrawal would be tough for sure. For sure. Well, I don't have any of the answers, but I do know I hope that our country can, wrap its collective head around this issue. And
Yeah, I hope so too. I hope that if treatment can be improved.
yeah, no, definitely. And thank you so much for your time this evening. It was very interesting. And I look forward to sharing this with my listeners and getting their feedback. Everybody usually emails me after they hear an episode. And there's been a lot of recent chatter about opioids. So this should be a good one.
Okay. Well, I hope so.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And like I said, it's this podcast is for discussion and no blame games or anything like that. So if I get hate mail for it, well, whatever. I'm just trying to have discussions. It's hard today to have discussions about controversial topics. Isn't it? I find it's hard. Sometimes I find myself trying to use my words so carefully that it's stressful.
Yeah, no, that's true. It is really very difficult. And you never know. You know, I would expect that you'll probably always get somebody objecting to something in your podcast, right? I
mean, oh yeah, all the time, all the time.
You're always going to. So trying to figure out how representative that is of anything.
100%. And I just tell people, listen, I'm a curious person. I can talk to anyone. I love hearing from smart people. You're obviously very smart. You did you did this research. We want to hear from people like you. I mean, that's how I view it, but that's me.
Yeah. Well, I'm sure you'll get a fair share of like, oh, she doesn't know what she's talking about.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I get that about myself too, but I mean, if you say anything, like you said, if you say anything today, you're going to get that. So that's just the way it is, I guess.
Yeah. All right. Well, thanks very much.
Yes. Thank you. And enjoy the rest of your evening. And I'm proud of my dog. He wasn't too bad. He got a little restless, but, he was pretty good the majority of the
right.
podcast.
The bone worked.
Yes, the bone worked, exactly.
All right. Bye then.
Bye-bye. Take care.
You too.
All right, you guys, thank you so much for joining in for this episode of Causes or Cures. I'm glad you were here. And, you know, let me know what you thought. You can reach me at bloomingwellness.com or find me on Instagram, Facebook, Twitter. I sometimes post there. And I enjoy getting feedback from you guys and hearing what you thought. If you are so inclined, if you like Causes or Cures, please share the episodes, tell your friends. The more the merrier. This is a totally grassroots, independent podcast. So I appreciate all the shares and all the comments that you guys provide. That said, definitely check out some of the other episodes that are posted and subscribe. If you do subscribe, stay tuned and new episodes will be posted shortly. I have some great guests coming on, so I hope you guys stick around. All right, talk to you soon. Take care of yourselves. Bye-bye.